Welcome to The Last American Vagabond. I'm very excited to be speaking with Dr. Richard Fleming today to discuss his perspective of what's going on today. And there's a lot of information we're going to try to go over in this conversation to create the counterbalance with the propaganda that's happening today. And a lot of it's backing up the discussions we've been having on this show. And I've been looking forward to this conversation. Thank you for joining me today. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as I said in the beginning, I know you're a busy man and appreciate the time. So let's jump right into this and discuss some of these concepts that I think are very, very pressing, very, very important for where we are today that are, as you've talked about many times, are completely being hidden by a massive propaganda campaign. So I actually would like to start with something you recently touched on that we've all been talking about, but I really want your take on this in regard to one part of what I've been discussing as the overall COVID illusion. And this, of course, is the PCR test. Now, you've mentioned the concept of the cycle thresholds and, you know, what Kerry Mullis has said in the past and that discussion. So what's your take on this in regard to how the PCR test could be or is being used in intentionally so or accidentally so in a way that creates an illusion using the cycle threshold?
Well, to begin with, a test actually doesn't give you a diagnosis to anything. People have had tests for years, whether that be blood tests or throat swabs or nuclear imaging or cardiac cath, the type of stuff that I do. And the test doesn't make a diagnosis. What happens is you get a test result, and then that goes to a physician who then has to put that information together along with what's happening to you and say, well, this is what this means. And a test has to be used correctly. As you undoubtedly know, I have a patented test called Fleming Method, which is a measurement test for using nuclear imaging that quantifies for the first time what we're looking at. And it was critical in the research that we did. But if you were to do that test incorrectly and not calibrate the cameras and not do it right, the test would be completely meaningless. And the same thing's true of polymerase chain reaction or PCR testing. Mullis did an outstanding job of developing a test that allows you to look for genetic material by having what's called a forward primer and a reverse primer that says start here, stop here. And if you see this sequence, we've got what we're looking for. And that's all it does. It says, is there this genetic sequence? And the test is supposed to be run at 20 cycles. His patent was very clear. It gives you 1,048,555 or something like that copies, which ought to be enough if it's there. And anything above that is not using the test correctly. And it's garbage. It's noise in the background. So, you know, one of the things I've done multiple times is just come out to defend Mullis because he did a good test, mm-hmm. but the people using the test are using it improperly. You know, you wouldn't want a cardiac cath or a nuclear study done by somebody who doesn't know what they're doing because the outcome would be completely meaningless. It would be garbage. And, you know, the interesting thing is that it's being used under an emergency use authorization, none of the EUA emergency use authorization should even exist at this point in time, given the substantial data that I've published and other people have talked about, although I would argue the difference between quantitatively measuring an outcome, just kind of thinking you see an outcome. But nonetheless, there's a ton of data out there about treatment availability and good outcomes that in and of itself deletes the category of EUA. So there's a lot being done that just according to the rules shouldn't be done.
Right. Well, the cycle threshold is the big point for me, and I'm sure that you've been discussing as well. So first of all, what is your perception of what the cycle threshold, let's say the average that's being used in this country right now?
Well, I'm not sure what the average is in the country because I don't get feedback from anybody. And you know, if you've been listening to me, I'm a scientist first, and I won't give opinions on a lot of stuff because there's a lot of people giving opinions. You don't need me on the program for an opinion. My grandmother would have given you one. But the reality is it's set at 20 cycles. We've listened to, you can see all the published data from CDC and WHO and all around the world. No, the people didn't set any of this at 20 cycles. So, you know, which is a different question from whether people really have COVID, because the diagnosis of the disease, which is different than having the virus, is a positive PCR test and a set of symptoms. And unfortunately, that set of symptoms especially if you look at it, could be the result of a virus, could be the result of a bacteria, could be the result of a fungus, it could be cancer, it could be a variety of things, gives you all these different symptoms that are just kind of being checked, boxed off. And, you know, medicine isn't practiced by just doing, well, let's mark this box, and now we're all happy and ready to go home. I will tell you what PCR testing has demonstrated to me. It is one of the four things that I think we have confirmed in the last 22 months. Respiratory viruses are spread from person to person by respiratory pathway. Congratulations. We can check that off the box. It's now confirmed viruses that are respiratory or pass from person to person by respiratory means.
Right.
Good job.
Right.
A lot of money, a lot of expense. And
And that one thing I always noticed, that's something that seems to have drifted as well as everything else in this conversation. At the beginning, it was a pretty common discussion. Even Fauci, I think, said it himself, that, well, respiratory viruses spread by symptoms primarily, whereas now it becomes this asymptomatic conversation. And we could dive into that forever, but I'll leave that one alone for today. It's just so many contradictions. But ultimately, I think it's important, as you've said as well, the PCR test, it comes down to essentially yes or no, as even Kerry Mullis has said himself in the past before he died in interesting, timely manner.
Yes.
But what's interesting there is that what you're laying out there is it's impossible to use that to use higher cycle thresholds to increase the view to only end up with a yes or no, which leads me to the next point of this, which I really am interested to hear what you have to say about variants, because if it's only a yes or no, how in the world are they able to use this test to argue that this is a variant versus a different variant?
Right. So the PCR test can't be used to determine variants. So this may go a little deep for some people, but genetic code, whether it's DNA or RNA, is made up of four different what's called nucleotide bases, and there's one difference between DNA and RNA. And so what we do if we want to know what something is we look at the genetic sequence of that code. And you know, this virus, SARS-CoV-2, has about 30,000 kilobases or 30,000 nucleotide bases. And if you want to know what the variants are, you have to take the sample out and you actually have to run all these bases, which is what we, you know, on FlemingMethod.com, we've got a lot of that data on some of the published materials and a lot of the presentations. I've tried to explain to people what the variants are. You can see where the nucleotide bases have shifted. And there's not one single type of SARS-CoV-2 virus any more than there's one type of person. There's all these variants. And we've always known that, you know, anything you have that's alive has more than one type of itself, if you will. And so to not have recognized this up front and not have worked with this is pretty sloppy. The vaccines that were selected out used the original spike protein coding sequence, which is called SARS-CoV-2 Wuhan HU-1. So that's the original spike protein version, but it's not the only version of it. It's just the one that was there in China. And so they kind of took that one and they said, well, what's the spike protein? What's towards the beginning of it, the forward primer, and what's towards the end of it, the reverse primer? And anything in between there could be any of a variety of things, and it will just pop up as that genetic code sequence. So you've kind of got the sloppy and quick approach, and then you've got the more fundamental scientific approach, and that's what you need to pick out the variant. So PCR testing isn't telling people you've got Delta variant, or you've got Mu variant, or Lambda variant, or any of the others, or even HU1. It's simply stating you've got a spike protein. And if you want to know what you've got to do the extra type of work. And there's a lot of work that has gone into that, but I'll guarantee you that it's not being done from the swabs that are being done in your nose and your throat.
And there's a lot of stuff to get into, which we will right there that you laid out, but just to that same point. So how is it that they are being told that these are, you know, the Delta variant is mostly here, mostly there? From my research, it seems that they're taking samples and estimations, but yet it's being given to us as absolute fact. So what's your thought on that?
Yeah, so the people that I depend upon, Luc Montagnier and Jean-Claude Perez, and the people that I work with, and they do the work on this. I'm the guy off to the side you know, collecting data and trying to help organize this stuff. But this is their bailiwick. They're the virology specialist, able to and Hotfield, I think it is the lady who works with them, and they've done the work of putting in the nucleotide bases out there, and you can pretty much track it. I think it is not, for me, it's not a question of whether Delta variant has primarily taken over, because the vaccine process that they've done and the way that they've done this by selecting out the HU1 spike protein has put pressure selection. So number two thing that we've learned in 22 months is that evolutionary theory of pressure selection is completely valid and works. And human beings, congratulations, have managed to spend a tremendous amount of time proving that now by doing, you know, and these drug vaccine biologics are akin to just a sloppy approach to doing this, very rushed out and not well thought out from a scientific point of view. But you know, if you build an immune response to a specific type of spike protein, this is very similar to the concept of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So as a good example, mm-hmm. if you take just a common gut bacteria called Escherichia coli, or E. coli for short, as a nice example, there's a lot of types of E. coli, some of which have no resistance to antibiotics, some of which have genetic codes called plasmids that are resistant to penicillin, some to amikacin, just a variety of antibiotics. And so if you have all of those in your gut flora, in your intestines, and you dump antibiotics into the body, you're going to kill off the ones that have no resistance, but the ones that do will survive, and they'll be the only ones that are able to replicate themselves, and you will put pressure selection. And so the additional interesting point on this is that if you want to deal with antibiotic resistance, the way you do it is you withdraw the antibiotics, you stop doing what's causing the problem, and you will get it back under control, and there will be enough of the non-resistant type to repopulate itself. And countries have recovered that way from these really bad bacterial resistance. So the reason for mentioning that is that when you use these drug vaccine biologics, as they've done to target HU1, what they're doing is for the immune response that does exist, which there's all sorts of questions about the T2 helper cells and interferon being suppressed by these drug vaccines, and those are critical for the innate immune response, which is the first part, the fundamental part of your immune response. But if you take some benefit out of this approach, what they're doing is they're putting pressure selection to the variants that are sufficiently different in their spike protein so that the antibody production has no effect. It doesn't respond to it. Now, we saw this last year originally, the first go round with the alpha variant in the UK. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, people kind of have short memories sometimes, but we've gone through alpha and beta and gamma, and now we've got lambda out there, and we've got delta. I mean, all it's done is taught a lot of people the Greek alphabet. But you know, if you're unless you're a scientist, and then it's kind of interesting. But the problem with this is that we've put pressure selection on this variant, and you know, the irony here is that adding a booster shot of doing the same thing is, you know, insanity is doing the same thing over again and expecting a different result. You know, it's kind of like when my students say, well, I'd like to try that drug again on the patient. It didn't work the first time, and you think it's going to work now. Why? You know, so stupid. Yeah, I mean, that I did say the S word, but it is applicable. It's applicable.
I'm so glad you said that, because this is something that seems so logical to me, and that, you know, pushback from the mainstream conversation, but it doesn't make any sense. Even if this wasn't a new variant, you're talking about doing the same thing that didn't end up giving the result, and that's going to increase it. It just doesn't logically add up. But this brings me to the conversation of what is actually causing these, because that's a big point, and or even if they're actually there. Like, what's your take on this? Because there's a lot of conversation of both of those, whether or not, I mean, the scientific research that I've seen, a lot of the stuff around the flu vaccine from before we got here was very clear that imperfect vaccination, specifically that one primary study that keeps the host alive, leads to this kind of thing, or that the flu vaccines from before have led to the creation of them. But there's also people arguing that this may be just a repackaging of vaccine adverse events as something else. So what are your thoughts on either of those?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind when we talk about influenza and prior vaccines is the Moderna lipid nanoparticle influenza vaccine from 3 years ago. And so I find it very disingenuous when people say, oh, golly, now we know that this vaccines, the lipid nanoparticles that are being injected for either Pfizer or Moderna spread throughout the body and don't stay at the injection site. And I find it very disingenuous for them to say that because this is not a news bulletin. Lipid nanoparticle is nothing but cholesterol and fats wrapped around the genetic code. And, you know, in 2017, Moderna did its lipid nanoparticle influenza study, and they found that it spread throughout the entire body, the brain, the bone marrow, the liver, the spleen, the heart, you name it. So, you know, so it was published a few years ago. For anybody to come in 2020 or 2021 and say, golly, what a surprise. You guys aren't actually reading your own research, I guess. And lipid nanoparticle technology, well, it's a great way to get things into the cell because it just merges with the cell wall, bypasses the receptor requirement. It has been shown to be a dismal failure in just about everything it's been used for, particularly chemotherapy, but, you know, now for these drug vaccine biologics. And so just a really bad idea. And by the way, you know, I know this may be boring to your listeners, but I'm going to go through it anyway because I'm just compelled as a research scientist.
I'm sure my audience will love it.
So when you inject, when something comes into your body, okay, like a virus naturally, SARS-CoV-2, the first part of your immune system is called your innate, I-N-N-A-T-E system. And it is dependent upon being able to see what's come into the body that's abnormal. Now, cholesterol and fats, a lipid nanoparticle, are not abnormal. I mean, we've got a lot of that in our bodies. So our innate response to that is blunted. It doesn't exist. It just bypasses it because our innate system, our T cells, look at that, and there's nothing about that that's abnormal or threatening. And then for the AstraZeneca and the Janssen, which a lot of people call Johnson & Johnson, but it's really Janssen, which are the adenovirus double-stranded DNA approach, the vector there, the entry mechanism is the adenovirus. And so when your T cells do see that for the innate system, the response is, oh, wow, adenovirus. Well, I thought we were actually vaccinating for SARS-CoV-2 or coronavirus. So the immune system is being told on first blush that it's actually an adenovirus that you're going after. So any of those approaches are either bypassing or interfering with our innate immune response. And then these get into the cells and really kind of begin backwards the approach already in an infected cell and now using our genetic material and ribosomes to make mostly spike protein in this instance, causing an immunologic response, except that where a person-to-person transmission of this virus would be hundreds, thousands, maybe 10,000. You know, if you got somebody really sneezing on you, it's like, you know, that was where your parents and grandparents said, stay home, don't go out and cough and sneeze on other people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't do that anymore. Now we just go out and cough on everybody. So congratulations, we spread it. But these vaccines, the lipid nanoparticle ones, the Pfizer, Moderna, show they have about 13.1 billion of the genetic code for the spike protein, and the AstraZeneca and Janssen have right around 50 billion. And so it shouldn't surprise anybody that we're having adverse events because if you have a healthy individual and they get exposed to that type of massive antigen load, you know, the proteins, the antigens that say this is abnormal, and your immune system is healthy and responds, you're going to get a massive response. And what I pointed out in 1994, when I committed heresy with American Heart, was that, you know, viruses are part of this inflammatory process that makes up heart disease and diabetes and high blood pressure and strokes and cancer. And so when you stimulate that inflammation and blood clotting, because that's what it is. It's an inflammatory thrombotic response. It's not cytokine release syndrome or cytokine storm. You're getting inflammation and blood clotting. And so since I've hit that, let me go back and cover cytokine release syndrome. So cytokines are nothing more than proteins that go from cell to cell to exchange information. And the reason why we have the term cytokine storm or cytokine release syndrome, two names for the same thing, is because Big Pharma developed many years ago a new type of immune therapy to go after cancers. And so what they do is they take your T cells out of your body. They all, much like they're doing for this gain of function for this virus. And then they, in the alteration of that, tried to tell them to go after the cancer cells. So, and then they inject it back into you. Now, those T cells aren't what T cells are supposed to look like. They're completely altered. They've been man-modified and altered. And so when they go back in your body, while they're looking for the cancer, they also tip off this massive reaction and the release of all these chemicals, which has been dubbed cytokine storm. Now, the benefit of that for Big Pharma was that once we have a name for something, humans tend to feel, oh, everything's okay. If we don't know what's going on, we don't have a name for it, then we stress out. But we can see the same thing and give it a name, and everybody's happy. And that's kind of what the PR did for immune therapy and what's called CAR, which is chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapy, where they take the T cells out. The difference is that's Big Pharma taking out your T cells and altering them. Inflammatory thrombotic response that I, you know, talked about first in 94 and have, I thought, beat to death since then over the last quarter of a century, is your immune system responding like it should to a massive attack within its body. Now, the reason why the people died with COVID and still continue to so frequently is because if you already have inflammation, blood clotting, these inflammatory thrombotic diseases, heart disease, strokes, diabetes, overweight, all the rest of that, already going on, and now you throw one more thing onto it, this virus, and you don't treat that inflammation and blood clotting, you end up with a lot of dead patients. So one of the other things we proved in the last 22 months is that if you have a problem and you don't treat it, you get bad outcomes. You know, so we've been spectacularly stellar, as I used to say, particularly when I lived in California, with what we've proven. You know, we've proven that patients don't get adequately treated for their problem. We're on a high risk of dying. Now what we're seeing is just a massive amount of this inflammation and blood clotting occurring in people that don't have those, what, quote, comorbidities that you've all learned as a term, other inflammatory thrombotic diseases. But because they're healthy and because there's billions of this stuff now being coded, a healthy person does what they should. A lot of inflammation and a lot of blood clotting to try to deal with it. Your body doesn't know that it's a man-made injected piece of genetic garbage. Mm-hmm. It knows it's got something foreign to the body and it's not supposed to be there. So, c'est la vie.
Yeah, that's just so incredible. I mean, it's amazing how we're at a point where, you know, your body's telling you there's a problem and we're ignoring that and listening to authority figures who tell us, no, it's safe and effective and it's meant to be that way, which contrasts how it used to be right before this. But speaking to the adverse events, before I go in, I want to talk about the specific, the Wuhan H1 strain and where that's at compared to today. But you touched on the adverse events. So just quickly, in your opinion, what's your thoughts on that in regard to the signals we're seeing from places like Bayer's? Or I just touched on yesterday, VigiAccess from the WHO that shows over 2 million worldwide, which I'm sure is much more than that. Just what are your quick thoughts on that?
Well, one of my quick thoughts is, you know, everybody can argue about what those numbers are. But, you know, seriously, in 1976, and I was dealing with patients in the hospital in 1976, although it was an orderly, you know, we had Guillain-Barré neurologic disease associated with the swine flu vaccine. And after the first 25 people died, everybody said, well, stop that. That's a bad idea. Right. And mainstream media did these, I mean, 60 Minutes did a great expose on showing that and exposing some of the lies that were going on with it. So part of me says, well, I don't really care whether it's 12,000 or 40,000 dead people. I mean, we kind of passed 25 a long time ago, right? You know, everything about this inflammation of blood clotting that – I'm sorry. I know it's my theory from 1994, and it sounds a little bit, you know, self-serving to keep pointing it out. But at what point in time do people have to, because I get a lot of people say, oh, yeah, we know about that theory. Okay, well, then when are we going to apply it, people? Mm-hmm. Because it's being applied. I mean, thanks, SARS, for validating the theory, I guess. But the reality is when you're seeing people have massive problems, okay, you should raise a question. The other thing that people frequently don't get to is that the emergency use authorization documents that are, and I've got them on the website. Mm-hmm. If you actually read those, you come away and scientifically, statistically analyze those, you come away with a different reality. Okay. The truth of the matter is that if you look at the data, not the vaccine efficacy garbage, okay, the absolute risk reduction, is there really a difference between what happens if you vaccinate somebody and you don't? And you take and you analyze the data that's actually in the emergency use authorization documents. And I've done this and I've presented it on, for me, ad nauseum number of presentations. It's like, it can't be that interesting, but apparently nobody else is doing this, so I'm going to keep beating it to death until somebody gets the point. If you look at the Pfizer vaccine and you do the math, the statistical analysis, based on their data, not mine, there is no statistical difference in the outcomes of vaccinated or non-vaccinated people. If you do it for Moderna, there is no statistical difference in the outcomes. If you do it for Janssen at 14 weeks, it turns out there is at what's called a P.05 level, which is, you know, 5%, which is what we use statistically for a cutoff. But 2 weeks later, at 28 days, that's gone. So, you know, beyond the VAERS issue is the fact that the data itself shows no reduction in COVID or death. Okay. Now we start looking at that VAERS data completely differently, which is, wait a minute, there's no benefit and we're having problems. And then you look at the data that's been done by other people and you realize that it doesn't matter whether that spike protein comes from the virus or the drug vaccine biologic, which just makes a lot more spike protein. Those spike proteins cross the blood-brain barrier. They have prion disease effects. And, you know, we're going to see this in about a year and a half. You know, that's when we're going to, I mean, we're already seeing some early changes of it. But, you know, this is a disaster that is coming forward to be seen by people. This is the gift that just keeps on giving, you know. And you've got Pfizer admitting that they have now, their head CEO has admitted that they have now made changes in their corporation so that if there's a variant that cannot be controlled at all by the drug vaccine biologics, in 91 days, they can come up with a new version. How about they just go back and take the actual original viruses if they want to make a drug vaccine and do what we've always done, which is take all the variants together with all of the parts, not just the spike protein, but the membrane, the envelope, the hemagglutinin, everything else that's associated with the bloody thing, put all the variants in there and develop an immune response to, I don't know, SARS-CoV-2. Then you've got the fact that, you know, and I mean, this just comes out. I don't know what degree you need to get this, but I thought second grade might do it. That if you've had the virus and you've developed an immune response to it, you've bloody well developed an immune response to it. Right. You might get another variant that might have a little bit more of an effect and you might not feel that good. And guess what? You're going to, as long as you're alive on planet Earth, you're going to experience this type of thing because Right. That's what happens. I love the whole thing about schools, you know, with people worrying about the kids in schools, because I don't know if you have any children. I have three. They're raised. They're grown adults. Schools are basically breeding grounds for everything. I mean, kids go in. I mean, you just need to go to a kindergarten class someday in reality time outside of this time and go look at all the runny noses and the stuff that's coming out of these kids. I mean, they're just... But amazingly, despite the fact that kids have always been these little disease factories, we've all somehow survived, which I don't know. I might be that immune system again, but I'm just winging it here.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, you take a child and you put them in a bubble and raise them there, and you put the child that raises in the kindergarten and you bring them both out and present them with something, and guess which one's going to have a better response? I mean, this is in basic stuff that we've known. But to go back to a couple points you made there. You touched on the idea of the emergency use authorization and the injection around the percentage. I think it's interesting that, as you probably know, that the percentage, even based on the Israeli studies and a lot of others, have shown that it's well below 50, which invalidates the emergency authorization. I just think it's important people to know. And I also want to add that you are saying that your theory being vindicated is self-serving, I even disagree with, because at this point we have people like Dr. Bakke, Dr. Yeadon, a lot of other people coming out and independently coming to the same conclusion. I think the data, as you've been saying, completely vindicates that out of its own right. And I think it's obvious as we see the blood clots, the vaccine-induced thrombosis, thrombocytopenia. Yeah. Like, we have a term for it that says vaccine-induced, and we still pretend like it's fake news. But finally, the fact that you really centered on something that I've been trying to drive home is that right now, their data makes your point. Their data makes my point, right? And the crazy part about it is we're going, look at the data, and they're going, well, they told us what it says. I trust the authority, so I did my research. And it's an infuriating moment that we're in, where we'll get to in a moment, the natural immunity, we're waving all these studies from every institution that they're telling us to listen to that say robust, lasting, memory B, TISA, and it's all fake news because the authority said so. It's mind-boggling that we can be here. And this brings me to the point about the strain versus as you named H1, or it's named H1, the Wuhan strain, the original strain, and Journal of Infection, I believe, is the study that I found that says quite clearly that if you are giving somebody an injection based on the original strain and they come in contact with Delta, which is what the study was based on, it's a clear risk. It creates the issue of antibody-dependent enhancement. So a couple points in that I want to get your opinion on. One, whether or not this is going to be a continual problem with any of the variants because of your point that it's not based on the right information, as well as the fact that is there any use to these at this point as the variants continue to go forward and they're just continuing to jam it forward?
Right. So antibody-dependent enhancement is this phenomenon where the presence of developing an antibody can actually make the problem worse. And I want to just take and use a previous example for people, which is Streptococcus pneumoniae or strep throat. And that's where you get those little white plaques in the back of your throat. Now, if you come and see most doctors, particularly if you come see a cardiologist like myself and you have strep throat, we're going to put you on antibiotics. And most people think that's to kill the bacteria, and that's true. That's what we want to do. But we also don't want you to make antibodies to the strep. And the reason for that is that the antibodies that are made to Streptococcus pneumoniae, this bacteria, also then look at the valves of your heart, and it looks an awful lot the same. And so those antibodies can attack the valves of your heart, and then you will develop stiffened heart valves over the course of time. And that's called rheumatic heart disease. And if that happens to you, you can have problem pumping blood out of your heart. You might need an artificial valve or a replacement valve down the line. So just because you can make an antibody doesn't always mean it's a good thing. The Osaka, Japan physician showed last year in 2020 that you can make antibodies to the spike protein, right? But you don't make it to just one part of the spike protein. You make it to what's called the regional binding domain, which is the part of the spike protein that attaches to the ACE2 receptor that many people have heard about now over the last 22 months, which is one of the receptors that are involved. But you can also make antibodies to what's called the N-terminal domain, and that N stands for nitrogen because that's the end of the spike protein, and nitrogen's on one part of a protein, and carbon is on the other part, so that's called the C-terminal. But antibodies to the N-terminal domain were shown by the Osaka, Japan physicians to actually increase and open up the spike protein to increase the infectivity of the spike protein by a factor of 4 to 10 times. So you may remember that back in 2020, last year, we had lots of people that were in hospital and they didn't think that they would die. Right? They thought they'd be okay because they had antibodies. Well, they did. They had antibodies to the regional binding domain, but they also had them to this N-terminal domain. And so the more of them that just happened to be the N-terminal domain, actually the worse their outcomes were. And it was also one of the reasons why convalescent plasma didn't work out as well as we all thought it would, because sometimes you're getting antibodies to the N-terminal domain. So that's one of the unique things, and that's different for this virus than we've ever seen before. Antibody-dependent enhancement in the past has meant that you will increase the inflammation and blood clotting by interfering with the antibodies and forming blood clots with what's called the complement cascade. All of that taken into consideration tells us that this is a virus, like most viruses, that are better responsive to our T cell, our innate immune system, than what's called our adaptive humoral system, which has been layered on top of the innate system. But you have to have the innate system to really work. And one of the problems that we're seeing with these drug vaccines that are being used is that the studies that are now being done, in addition to showing an increased antibody-dependent enhancement, is that these vaccines are also suppressing our innate T cell response, specifically something called T helper 2 cells, which is critical, and interferon, which is critical. Now, T helper 2 cells help the antibody cells make antibodies and tell them, yes, this is exactly right. And interferon, while it sounds like a mysterious substance, comes from the term because doctors and scientists were not that imaginative. Sometimes we're kind of blunt. It interferes with viruses. So it's interferon. So all the mysticism of that word kind of loses its luster when you realize that it just means interferes. There's three types. But it's interesting to know that the animal models show and the people that are having data shown that those values are down. The T helper 2 cells are down. The interferon's down. When you now expose people, which is called challenging, after the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines have been given and you challenge them with influenza, it turns out that many people are not even making the expected immune response for influenza. So I'm not really sure how good an idea this is to be double vaccinating people for influenza and SARS-CoV-2, right, given the data. And like I said, you know what, like I keep saying, and why I put up the website is, look, you know, I'm not asking you to like me as a person. You know, frankly, it doesn't matter to me whether you like me as a person. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm like everybody else. I like to be liked. But as a scientist, you know, that's where I just kind of draw the line and says, it doesn't matter whether you like me. The science is the science. You know, if I'm telling you something you don't like, what is that? It's the messenger versus the message type thing. Mm-hmm. And so I always tell people, look, don't take my word for it. The reason why there's over 200 papers on that one section of it anyway, and more on the rest, it's called the heuristic method, which is, you know, don't take my word for it. Go read it. It's there. You guys can read it on your own. You don't need me to, you might benefit from me interpreting, but you know, you can take it and share it with whomever you want to. Take it to your favorite scientist or your favorite doctor or your favorite whoever, your favorite aunt, and have them interpret it for you and go from there. So I, you know, the entire thing is that it's not my opinion. I don't even have opinions on this. I'm just laying out the science. Yes. You know, it's like people who come and listen to me year after year after year, and I get people come up and say, well, Dr. Fleming, that's not what you said 10 years ago. Okay, great. I've learned something, I guess.
Right.
You know, if you want to know what I'm going to say in 5 years, please come back and listen to me, because I don't know what I'm going to be saying until we get the data and it accumulates. Right. I don't know what I'm going to be saying in 2 to 5 years on the outcomes of these prion diseases associated with this virus, and particularly with the vaccines, because there's data that shows that it's a problem for both.
If I can interject real quick, I just want to point out that's one reason why I appreciate your work so much, because you provide the source material for what you're saying. And this is the frustrating part about where we are today, is that so many people are trusting people in authority positions to tell them what they're supposed to think, and you're giving them the data to look at for themselves. But because people get labeled as debunked or whatever, the cancel culture, they just ignore that data. And that's what's so infuriating. So I value that and I appreciate that in your work, because not many people are doing that today.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. You know, you using the measured data, I mean, in the research that we did, I was able to use the Fleming method, the quantitative test, to measure the outcomes of the treatments that were given to people. And in the course of doing that, we were able to see combination drugs and what they actually did to people. And, you know, we measured the outcome of remdesivir in people when it was the first line drug, and it worked 28% of the time. And the reason why that's important is that if you have a drug that can make you better, worse, or stay the same, that's a 33 and a third, 33 and a third, 33 and a third, which means it underperformed chance. And the other thing was that when it was combined with alpha interferon and or tocilizumab, so alpha interferon is a form of interferon, and tocilizumab is a interleukin-6 inhibitor that reduces the inflammation in the body. When you combine them, you got an even worse outcome. So, you know, sometimes drugs that you put together, you have to be very, very careful when you combine drugs and what you're really doing. And you have to think about the overall outcome. I mean, I've seen some people with some massive, what I consider just cauldron, tells you what I think of it, combinations of drugs, because they're just kind of shooting in the dark. And I take a very unpopular stance in the medical community with people on the other side when I say, you know, we don't have any data. We don't have any measured data that shows ivermectin or budesonide works. I respect and appreciate the people that are working with it and trying to propose it, but, you know, ivermectin has no data to show that it stops viral attachment or replication of the inflammatory thrombotic response. What it does do, what there is data on for ivermectin, is that it protects the nucleus of the cell from having genetic material enter into the nucleus. That's well worked out data. Budesonide, I don't have any data that I've seen that's published quantitatively that determines what it is. So if you have a steroid, which is what that is, and you put it in the lungs, but you've got inflammation and blood clotting going on throughout the body, well, it's not having any effect on the rest of the body because you just put it in the lungs. So you have to ask these very hard questions. And this is 53 years of research for me. And I love the fact that if I, you know, probably shouldn't use that word, you know, I do a research project and the outcome isn't what I expect, right? Mm-hmm. Which is too often the case.
Science.
And what you do is you go, why didn't that, you know, turn out the way? And what you do is you learn from that so much that it really, you start to reflect back on it and go, how could I have been so stupid to not have gotten that? You know, it's kind of like a lot of the vitamins and minerals that we talk about people taking for their immune system. Well, you know, there's data that actually shows that works.
Right.
You know, it's measured outcome data. So, you know, and, you know, where I went to medical college, you know, was a challenge because we were taught that, and we were taught this isn't alternative medicine. This is our where we started in medicine. This is part of our foundation. So it's not alternative medicine. It's part of what you need to remember. I mean, I have seen so many people that are hospitalized that are not getting nutritional support. They're not getting any caloric intake or protein intake or lipid intake or carbohydrates. Well, that means they're being starved. And I don't know about you, but I don't see a lot of people that get better if they're starved. So, you know, starving patients to death, well, there we go. 22 months, we've proven also if you starve patients to death, they will do poorly. I mean, it's been a brilliant 22 months for us.
If I could ask your opinion, and I know you said you'd like to stick away from the opinions, but just what your take on it, how do you think it's possible that so many people in the medical community, like nurse level, doctor level, can on a dime watch the narrative shift to where these things are now fake news, whereas moments ago, this was common knowledge? And a quick side note, my dad in a similar situation was sent home after being told he was sick with no treatment other than to come back when you get worse. It just, I don't even understand that.
Yeah, you know, and this is, it's one of the arguments I've made, which is we have never, when we had patients come into the hospital with breathing difficulties, never not treated that.
Right.
We have never not treated concerns with inflammation. I mean, you know, aspirin is one of the dirt cheapest drugs there is out there and probably one of the most therapeutic in so many different things. It's like, what, did everybody's brains just fall out in 2019? And we've got this paradigm shift that just, you know, and so the reality is there's not a single reason for why this has happened. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the problem. I mean, you have very well-intentioned doctors that are you know, so I'm going to back this up. So I'm a PhD, MD, JD. So PhDs figure out problems, MDs treat problems, and JDs cause problems.
For those that don't know, JD, what is it, Doctor of Jurisprudence?
Right, jurisprudence doctor. So, you know, if you're an MD or a DL, you're a clinician. You're used to treating problems, but you don't solve problems. You don't figure them out. That's what the PhDs, that's what we do. You know, and so that's why I've always said the best of all worlds is to be a PhD MD because you can do the research and you understand how it's clinically important, and clinically you can tell the PhD what needs to be worked on, right? So you get this, and that's why the best programs have the two working together. And if you don't, you have bad outcomes. So, you know, the function of a clinician is to, I've been taught this is the answer. Here's what I do. Well, what we've seen beginning in late 2019 was the federal government, it's not only this federal government, but, you know, three-letter agencies coming out and going, doctor, this is the treatment. And so good clinicians follow that pattern. I mean, that's you know, the way you get people that can regurgitate a tremendous amount of knowledge under stressful circumstances are people that can memorize and follow orders. And that's kind of what they're doing. But unfortunately, I mean, I'm also old enough that HIV, I was in medical college when that hit the scenes. And you know, that was kind of like, we have not seen this before. And everything they told us we would never see, we're now seeing. So I think there are a lot of very well-intentioned people, but the reality is we're 22 months into this. The thing that I think irks me a little bit is when they say, yeah, we know about inflammation and heart disease. And then, well, more than a quarter of a century ago, I brought that to you and you haven't applied it.
Right.
Now I want to know why you haven't applied it. You know,
yeah.
The ventilators that were set too high. So, you know, we geared up and made a lot of ventilators and then used them incorrectly. Not my data. In the early 2000s, several committees of physicians that specialized in just ventilators demonstrated that if you had somebody with inflammation in their lungs, what's called acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS, which is what SARS patient, COVID patients have, you have to set the ventilator differently or you will kill the patient. Well, guess, you know, in 22 months, congratulations again, we proved again that those papers in the early 2000s, so yes, see, everybody's had time to read them, be familiar with them, be educated with them. We proved that those committees were in fact correct on ventilator settings and that you kill patients. Congratulations. Yeah. I won't accept that, you know, everybody was overloaded and overworked, because I'll tell you that as a cardiology fellow, good grief, we saw people come into the hospital who were having their heart attacks, myocardial infarction, and we saw them, tested them, treated them, diagnosed them, and they left the emergency room, which is as far as we had gotten for them 7 to 10 days ago, because our hospitals were full. We're not more full than we were when I was a cardiology fellow.
Right.
60 patients plus a day for a cardiology fellow to deal with the rule in, rule out coronary care units and the step down units, which is typically what we had. Okay, are they seeing more than 60, 70 patients a day? I don't think so. You know, yeah, so
that's been shown pretty clearly in the contrast with NIH specifically of the flu, where every year in the past you can see where they're saying the same thing, overwhelmed, and it's no different than previous years.
Yeah. You know, if you're feeling overwhelmed with this, you kind of need to gear up with it. The people that have been saying we weren't trained for this, this isn't what we're. Yeah, you were. That's what medicine's about. I mean, people don't come into the hospital because they're healthy.
Right.
You know, this is, I mean, you know, as much as I like to think that we're just great human beings, nobody comes, well, the little old ladies do. Nobody comes to see their doctor because they just want to see you, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of like the dentist. I mean, dentists get a little bit more that preventive care. But most of the time, when you're coming in to see doctors in the hospital, you're not feeling good and you're not there for a social visit. Right. And you'd like something to be done. And so to just go, well, we have nothing we can treat you for. I think this is where I now kick out the fact that I trained as a cardiologist in Houston with good people like DeBakey and Cooley and a few others, and I'm delighted that they've passed because they didn't have to live through this nonsense. They would not have tolerated the federal government telling them how to practice medicine. Okay, look. When the federal government tells you that you can't use medications to treat people because they will die with that, and then they're dying without those medications,
right?
You can't kill them more than dead. So if what they're telling us to do doesn't treat the patients, this is where the clinicians say, the good ones say, well, you know what? I'm going to try this. And there were a lot of good clinicians that I spoke to that were using the higher dose steroids, which is what it has to be. It can't be this low dose steroid nonsense. Mm-hmm. The higher steroids that we've always used in medicine for people with pulmonary lung diseases that come in because they can't breathe, we've always nebulized them, given them breathing treatments every 4 hours and put them on high dose steroids and put them on antibiotics to kill the bacteria, which, by the way, one of the problems that we have here is that everybody wants to call these drugs based upon what we normally treat them used to treat them for versus how they work, their mechanisms of action. The reasons why the antibiotics work is because they're interfering with the replication of the virus by working on the ribosome. And there's all sorts of data that shows that that's true too. So yeah, they kind of maybe do work for bacteria, but they also work for viruses. And the literature, the research data shows that. And I didn't do the data. I mean, other people did this research, right? So either we're all completely nuts and these three-letter federal agencies are just composed of brilliant people, which, excuse me while I get sick on that thought. The reality is they don't have it down. They don't know what they're talking about. They've never treated a patient. I love the social media experts who know nothing about treating patients and suddenly think that they're PhDs and MDs. Right. Where all these bloody brilliant people came from and how they all got that way without ever having to get the education is beyond me. But I guess there was a simpler, less expensive way to do it than the way that I did it.
You know, for me, it always comes down to choice, right? I mean, I had a hard time even discussing some of these alternative treatments, remdesivir, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, just because I'm not a big supporter of big pharma anything at this point. And I'm just kind of, not that they can't have value, right? But I'm just like, I don't want to promote them. The point is you should have a choice, especially if you're in a position where they're going, well, we can't do anything else. It's like, well, let's try anything then, right? And so, you know, I've seen some of these new studies coming out, the crossover, even ivermectin saying like the antiviral possibilities there. And the point is that individuals should have the right and the doctor should have the authority to be able to describe what they think is right. And I think that's a no-brainer, you know. And this brings me to a point that I know we're slightly limited on time, so I want to talk about the idea of you mentioned the discussion of the Dr. Ryan Cole has put it this way, has discussed the lowering of the CD8 T cells, I believe, in regard to the after the injection and what that can lead to in regard to increasing more infection. It brought to mind DoD study from before all of this in regard to the flu injection and how that was shown to increase the risk of infection as well as other coronaviruses, 39%, if I remember correctly. So could you comment on that for me in regard to Cole's claims and what you think?
Yeah, so CD8 killer cells are critical for the innate immune system. I mean, these cells are part of what looks at cells that are infected and then recognize the infection and then release chemicals to actually punch holes in the cells that are infected to kill those cells and to make it impossible for the virus to replicate. So if you suppress CD8 killer cytotoxic cells, you're going to have an impaired innate immune system. And again, this is showing up in this research that's been done to demonstrate that these drug vaccine biologics are impairing the innate immune system. And one thing that I think is critical here that I'll take it back to the emergency use authorization documents. If you go to those EUA documents, and these are documents that say these drug vaccine biologics have an effect. Now, how do we know they have an effect, right? Well, the way that they kind of handled it is they took this observational approach that you've already heard me criticize. You need measurements, not just the patients kind of look like they did okay. But the drug vaccine biologics got away with doing that, right? They said, well, you know, we didn't see that many COVID patients. And now they're ignoring the fact that they didn't see that many COVID patients if you didn't get the vaccines and you were in the control group, so to speak, not getting vaccinated. But what you don't see is the measured data. You don't see anything about the T cell levels. You don't see anything about the T helper 2 cell levels or the CD4 or the CD8 cells or the interferon level. You don't see anything on the antibody titers. You don't see the IgM, IgG, and specifically IgA, because this is a respiratory pathogen, and that's a respiratory and GI elicits an IgA antibody response. You see none of that. Now, if your proposal is, I have a drug that causes an immune response, then the thing that you need to measure to prove an immune response are all those things I just said. And none of that is in the EUA documents. I mean, they have peripheral fluffy things that say, we noticed a certain percentage antibody change.
Right.
Okay, pardon my French, where the hell's the data? Okay, because you've got tons of tables telling me what sex they are and what age group they are and what comorbidities they are. You know, it's a long document, but I'm a research scientist. Throw them in there for me, guys. I'd like to see them, because if I don't see them, the rule of thumb is you didn't do them. And if you don't have measured outcome data of the things that say you got an immune response, then – you know, scientists, physicians like myself kind of look at it and go, no supporting data. All this fluff stuff okay, we have people that don't look like they developed COVID or died. Okay, that's a clinical observation, right? And I already beat that to death, right? So if I beat it to death for the other guys, you know I'm going to beat it to death for the drug vaccine people, because it's you know, that's fair play, right? If I mean, if it's applicable on one side, it's applicable on the other side. If Fleming's demanding that we measure outcomes, then by God, I want to see measured outcomes, because that's how you really know what you've got. And when you don't have any data on that, you got to sit there and go, they have no data to prove what they're talking about. And the people at the FDA aren't calling them on this. And, you know, I already have my wonderful give and take with the FDA, you know, where I've tried to point out radioactive isotopes and misrepresentations by big pharma and double dosing people and billions of dollars being made. But, you know, in some of the comments that they made by this, one of the comments that they came back to me in later years was, well, Fleming, you need more coronary cardiac cath data. And I came back with them and I said, no, I don't, because I've got quantitative coronary arteriography. And they said, well, you know, the experts would tell you that you need more cath data. And I responded, no, they wouldn't, because there's only five experts in the field: Dietrich, Zur, De Bruin, Bowman, and Fleming. And none of us are at the FDA. right? Funny. I mean, we're the five people that have written the papers in the literature on the quantitative data. So I know Dietrich Zur and DeRuin and Bowman aren't there, and I sure as heck aren't. Am not there. So who at the FDA with a second grade education is saying that they're smarter than the five guys that are, well, four guys and one woman who wrote the paper, right?
It's hilarious to me. The very experts, yourself included, are the people that are being dismissed simply because the narrative is not appropriate in their minds, right? It's not about facts is what we're seeing. It's just narrative. It's amazing. Yeah. Well, the idea that this obviously crossed over into the idea of natural immunity and the interesting part of this that I've seen so far is that right now they're really focusing in on or really kind of trying to ignore and downplay the waning antibodies after the injection while over pointing to the waning antibodies of the natural immunity, except they're omitting the part that you just talked about, the memory B, the T cells, you know, the fact that all of these institutions they're telling you to point to are saying it's robust, it's lasting, and all this stuff. So what are your thoughts on that in regard to natural immunity and you know, the crossover?
Right, so the reality is you only make antibodies for what you're being exposed to at the time, okay? They're proteins. And so if you made antibodies for everything you've ever been exposed to, your blood would be so viscous or thick with proteins, it wouldn't float and you'd die. It'd be one massive blood clot, okay? Not to mention it would be a tremendous waste of energy and resources for the human body. So you only make antibodies when you're being challenged with the infection, right? So you make what's called memory cells. You make memory T cells that gear up the innate system when you need it. And you make memory B cells, which, by the way, takes that T helper 2 cell to make that we've already talked about the vaccines are suppressing. And you keep those in memory so that when you get exposed to the infection, then you will gear up your memory cells to respond to it, and it won't take as long. So it shortens the duration of symptoms. And note one of the important comments that kind of slid in there. The only time a vaccine has any benefit is when you get infected by what you got vaccinated for. Otherwise, it has no mystical property at all by being in your body. It is the fact that you now have to get infected. So people who think that vaccines keep you from getting infected or spreading an infection to somebody don't have a very good understanding. And for the general public, listen, that's fine. I cut all of you a break because, you know, look, you don't want me doing your taxes. You don't want me doing, I mean, I can do some auto mechanic stuff, but my brother was a tank mechanic for the U.S. Army. And, you know, it wasn't going to be him. You know, I was not going to compete with this guy, right? You don't want me drilling around in your mouth. I'm not a dentist. I'm not trained to do it. All right. So if it's not what you're trained to do, and I understand viruses are not where most people are expected to have knowledge base, I'm going to give you a pass. Although at 22 months, I'm giving less and less of a pass to people. But if you're in the field and you've got this confused, look, it was either Pfizer or Moderna's CEO. I forgot which company she works for. Who, when they had the hearings for the booster, okay, said T cell response isn't important in infectious disease, okay? Now, I listened to that and I thought, and you're the head of vaccine development for your company. And you don't think T cells, I mean, so you need to talk to the scientists that work for your company because you obviously are clueless on this, okay, and shouldn't be talking for the company because it makes you all look stupid. There's that S word again. But if the IQ points fit, wear them. So, you know, and so, look, if you get a drug vaccine biologic that causes you to form an immune response and make memory cells, memory T cells and B cells, or if you get exposed to the same thing that causes you to make T cell and antibody responses and then make T cell memory cells and B cell memory cells, and you're trying to make an argument that the natural acquisition approach doesn't work, well, then the premise for the drug vaccine biologics doesn't work. It's the same premise. You know, it's the goal of getting you exposed to a less virulent or nasty version of it than you would if you got exposed. So if you got exposed, you got exposed to a more nasty virulent version, supposedly, than the drug vaccines, right? Mm-hmm. Which means if you survived, which apparently, you know, a lot of us are, because I've had two versions of it now, right? I mean, I had it back in January of 2020, and I had it 2 months ago when somebody was kind enough to share the Delta variant with me. And let's see, I'm 65, so I guess I'm in one of those comorbidity groups. And I still made it twice. Sorry to disappoint people. So I'm guessing my natural immunity must be, I don't know, borderline tolerable. You know, to say that one, you know, natural immunity doesn't do it. I mean, look, there's papers studied, published, that shows if you have been exposed to influenza,
right,
and some forms of cytomegalovirus, you already have what's called T-cell receptor immunity. This is the part of the T-cell that recognizes other things like SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus. You already have some natural immunity to this virus, okay?
Right.
Yay! Biology works. Another thing that we learned after 22 months is that the evolved, or wherever you're at, whatever gets you to immunity, works.
We've learned a lot. No, excuse me. I've been trying to point out many times that there's a lot of that that's been built up for, I mean, even since the 2020 forward, from Nature, from The Lancet, basically making the argument that you, I think JCI was one of them, Insights, basically laying out the argument that their controls ended up having results for an antibody reactivity, which didn't make sense until you realize, oh, well, it's from SARS, it's from the common cold. You know, and there's a lot of these being shown there, and they're showing the majority of adults showed some form of antibody reactivity before this ever came around. It's the fact that none of that can be considered in the mainstream conversation is criminal in my mind. I mean, it's unreal, based on especially what you've been laying out for us.
Criminal is a good word for it.
Yes. Well, yeah. I say right. If you could touch on for me one thing before we end up talking about your perception or your opinion based on your research around the idea of bioweapon versus not the HIV inserts, and then what your petition's about. Can you touch on for me one point before we get into that, around the concept of the spike protein and the whether or not it ends up in your bloodstream? Because of the point you just made, I think, is really relevant and easy for the average person to wrap their mind around. You explained how too much protein in the blood can make it would just be clogged up. And so, interestingly enough, the research showing the spike protein through the bloodstream, you know, what are your thoughts on that? And is that what you're seeing?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's hard to tell what all is happening because, again, we're limited somewhat by the data that's being acquired, but anybody, it would be impossible to make an intelligent scientific argument that drug vaccines that we know spread throughout the body, and we've known that at least for the last 4 or 5 years now, if we didn't know it beforehand, means that genetic sequence to build the spike protein is spread all around your body. We know that for these spike proteins to get an immune response going, they have to be presented to the surface of the cell. And so we know that there's an inflammothrombotic response going on anywhere that these spike proteins are presenting themselves if they're from the vaccines. And it's unconscionable that you would think that somehow that doesn't happen, because it completely ignores everything we know about immunology and how vaccines work and inflammothrombotic responses to disease. What was the other part of the question, Ryan? Sorry.
No worries. No, just about the idea of the spike protein in general, and the with this new conversation about the applying the injection inappropriately in a way that goes too deep or ends up in the bloodstream, but kind of being the argument for why that can happen and showing that directly leads to myopericarditis. But my thought is that, and whether you're seeing that happen, whether that's just a kind of cover story for something that's happening more, because I've seen the research that shows it ends up in your bloodstream. 11 out of 13 people anyway showed it in their bloodstream one day after the research.
Yeah, well, the reality is that the vaccines don't stay at the site of injection, and they're moving by bloodstream, they're moving by lymphatics. One of the things that I'm just kind of puzzled by, that, you know, it may just be my little old brain and there's something wrong with me, is that the way I was taught to give an injection was you gave an injection and then you aspirated back or pulled back on the needle to make sure you weren't in a blood vessel.
Right.
Because obviously if you inject into a blood vessel, that has bad outcomes.
That's what the research was talking about right there,
the
lack of that. And in fact, they were told not to do that by certain institutions.
Yeah, and I see none of them actually aspirating it back. So it's like, what happened to all that training? Again, this is a pre-2019, post-2019 phenomenon, which is what happened to, we don't aspirate on injections anymore. We quarantine healthy people. We see people in a hospital that are sick and we don't treat them. We have doctors with patients in a hospital who want to treat patients, and we threaten to take their medical licenses from them or call them criminals to do that. We question anybody who questions anything. You know, I mean, Gehring would be just ecstatic, you know, when during Nuremberg too, when he was being tried, Nazi Germany. He just point blank told the American attorneys and everybody else that any government could get any people to do anything if they told them there was a problem, told them what the answer was, and told them that anybody who resisted that answer was a traitor to the country or a terrorist. And the American attorney jumped back on that and said, no. In the United States, we're elected, you know, we have a democracy. And so FYI, this is not a democracy. This is a republic to begin with. It's go look up your American politics journal on that one. Democracy is everybody has an equal voice. Republics are you elect people to represent you in a republic. Actually, Gehring came back and he said, no, he says republic, because he didn't even get fooled by the term democracy. Republic, parliament, socialistic, communistic, fascist, says it's the same thing. You know, and Gehring is probably turning over in his grave right now just laughing, because that's exactly what's happened. You know, when the president of the United States, let's just hit on this. If you do not provide informed consent to patients, first off, as a physician, you've not only violated the American Medical Association Code of Ethics, but you've violated the Declaration of Helsinki, you've violated the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and you've violated the Nuremberg Code, all of which require informed consent. Now, other than the Nuremberg Code, these are all treaties. And according to the U.S. Constitution, treaty law, the Constitution, and statutes, anything Congress passes, are the law of the land. If you're an elected official or an appointed official and you take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, and you tell people that informed consent is no longer required, you have violated treaty law, therefore you have violated your oath, which is treason by definition. I just put that out there as we get up to the ICC part of the discussion on this, because to commit treason in the United States is an act that is punishable by death, just as a thought. If you're an elected official or an appointed official and you are brought before Congress and you are asked point blank questions, is the U.S. government involved in gain of function research? And you sit there and you lie through your teeth and say, we don't do that. Well, okay, I'm not the judge or the jury on this, but I think that's called perjury. Of course, it's up to them to decide. And perjury is a criminal offense. Okay? The
If I can just jump in real quick, I think what's interesting is that there's plenty of more examples. I mean, the gain of function research is such an obvious one, and that was such a huge example of how he can lie about something. I mean, as he's waving the paperwork around, and as we all can see it, and in fact, people like myself have done shows about that research before COVID ever came around, like the idea of the bioweapon research and so on. So it's very clear stuff. Dr. Boyles came out and talked about this, but there's plenty of other research around things like, for instance, you touched on informed consent. I keep pointing to research from December 2020 that talks about antibody-dependent enhancement, and that was a specific and significant concern. And there's a lot of that out there. And, and this is why I think it's so important that we focus on what you're ultimately getting to here in the discussion of your petition and the discussion around where this should go. But if maybe you could talk about them simultaneously, your thoughts about the idea of bioweapon, you know, Ralph Barrick, Peter Daszak, North Carolina University, that kind of conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, for my opinion, just to lay it out in the beginning, I see this as being an overlap from multiple governments, Wuhan, Fort Detrick, right? I mean, there's a huge thing going on here that I think is impossible to be one or the other. I think there's a lot going on together, but it doesn't have to necessarily mean all of them. I mean, there's factors within each government, but I'd love to have your thoughts on where you think that lies in regard to whether this was an intentional concept, a leak, or, you know, there's a lot of discussions there. And then let's end on talking about your petition, which I think is really important.
Right. So part of what I did, and I don't want to sound like a commercial, but I wrote a book called Is COVID-19 a Bioweapon, a Scientific and Forensic Investigation, where I laid out much of this information for people. Again, so you don't have to take my word for it. You can go read the documents, you can read what's in the book, or you can go read the original articles by themselves. And intentionality is an interesting question, but when you've been doing more than two decades worth of research, it's you know something's happening. It's not an accident. It's not involuntary. Nobody forced to do this. When you're receiving U.S. federal funds and funds from foundations in the United States and funding around the world, and that funding, you know, in the United States, more than half of it was paid by the Department of Defense, who doesn't work with the Girl Scouts. Went to Peter Daszak at EcoHealth, who provided money to Ralph Barrick at the University of North Carolina, to Xi Zhang Li at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. There's multiple other universities that have received gain-of-function research in the United States for a variety of things. We've had gain-of-function shut down at this in this country because of leaks of these very concerning gain-of-function viruses. You know, the principle of altering cells like CAR T cell therapy, where I talked about earlier with cytokine release syndrome, is the same type of research that's done with gain of function research. So it sounds like your viewers probably know it, but for those who don't, gain of function is where you take something, a virus, for example, and you make it either more infective or more dangerous by manipulating it. And so in the book, with the papers that I've put in there, which has been presented as evidence to the International Criminal Court, you can see a sequence of more than two decades of where these people have worked on viruses to change the viruses intentionally, to make them more infective, to insert HIV components into them, to insert what's called the furin cleavage site, which are four specific amino acids, each amino acid having three nucleotide bases, so that's 12. And mutations that occur naturally occur one at a time, not 12 at a time. And Luc Montagnier has done a very good job of showing all the inserts into SARS-CoV-2 that are HIV or SIV, which is simian or ape immune deficiency virus. And there's over 1,700 of those bases that are in this virus. Xi Zhang Li originally introduced HIV glycoprotein 120 by her acknowledgement, which overlapped research that I was doing in the early 1990s, which is what got the federal government on my case in the 1990s, because it turned out that the very research that I was doing was overlapping, although I didn't know it at the time. I was just doing my research. It just happens to be their research that they were doing too, with the new 5-AC raft, which is where the glycoprotein sits in and starts the initial attachment so it can begin infecting cells. Wrong place, wrong time, I guess, but it was still good research. I'd do it again. So all of that shows an intentional action. A lot of people have dug up some of the papers talking about the spike protein of one coronavirus and the backbone of another one. But what they haven't done is dug into the supplemental material that goes with those papers. And when you do that, you find out that five very specific nucleotide bases were altered, one in the envelope of the SARS-CoV-2, which is critical for infectivity of this virus. The furin cleavage site, that PRRA insert cleavage site, is critical for infecting, and for neuropilin 1, which is another receptor site. And it just happens that the U.S. federal government owns the enzyme insertion patent for furin cleavage sites. That's the type of stuff where when Anthony Fauci is sitting before Senator Dr. Rand Paul and says, you know, we're not doing any funding of research for coronaviruses, and then you see the patent, which, you know, I've talked about several times, it's in the book, for altering spike proteins of coronaviruses paid for by NIH and NIAID. You know, I sit there and I find that very comical, because it's, at what point in time did you not think to just shut up? I mean, you know, if nothing more, just shut up. But don't lie. I mean, because, you know, it's like everybody and their uncle has, I think, seen that footage, that clip.
I think they believe they have impunity. I think they're quickly realizing it's not as sound as they thought it was. But I think, you know, they believe that they have a system on their side, you know, and go ahead.
Yeah, no, and I think that they're now beginning to look at who to throw under the bus next. And, you know, I think that's why Redfield got off the bus when he got off the bus. And when he got off, I knew it was all going to hit the fan, because you saw how they doubled down on that. And every time something new comes, it doubles down on it. So one of the ironic things that I find right now is, you know, so this is because it's been engineered, because they've been playing gain of function. This is a bioweapon. By definition, a biological weapon is something that you make. Yeah, that's a good one to show. That is not naturally occurring, that can't be positive. So SARS-CoV-2, SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2, which is, by the way, the seventh one that we know of that infects people, was first coined in 2019. However, the paper that you're showing right now was the one that I've talked about before, and it's in the book, where Chinese scientists put four viruses together, parts of four viruses, and you can see them. Hepatitis C virus, HIV-1, SARS-CoV-1, and SARS-CoV-2. I mean, it's there in black and white. So if you have a doubt about how long this virus has been floating around and being played with, your answer is in the paper you just showed, right?
And make sure people see that it is 2006, right? That it's this right. Blew me away, by the way, in your presentation. Just that, I mean, just to make another quick point here, if you actually try to go to Google Trends, which is supposed to represent if these things are being used online, you will not find a 2006 example of SARS-CoV-2, or just without the dash, which is how it's being displayed. It shows you, how is that possible unless there's something that's being hidden? I mean, this kind of, why don't you touch on this really quickly? How do you explain how that can be listed as SARS-CoV-2 on this document for 2006, yet they act like it was a new thing and newly discovered name that they used in that time?
Right. So one of the things, remember I made the comment about PhDs, that the function of a PhD is to figure problems out. Mm-hmm. Never piss off a PhD. Okay. Because we will investigate it and get to the bottom of it, right? So that clearly wasn't something that they ever put in or ever wanted to be seen. But, you know, 53 years of research and teaching, I'm extremely methodical on how I go about things. And I ask questions that my brain makes sense to my brain, but probably not to a bunch of other people, which is fine. Again, it's not a love fest. I'm not trying to get people to think. So the reality is I just kept digging and investigating. You asked certain questions along the way. And so there were several questions that I had that I, you know, went through a variety of sources that I have access to and many that the rest of you have access to, and sorted this out. And I dig through papers and I read the references that are in papers because that's why they're in papers. And which is always one of the questions that people should ask, because when a statement's made in a paper, a lot of times those statements aren't even valid if you actually go read the paper that was written about it. And you go, well, that's not what that paper says. I mean, you know, but the vast majority of people and a lot of journalists will ramp it out there. So when people throw me journalist articles, no insult to journalists, I just go, yeah, that's nice. Where's the original paper? I have to read it. I can't do this off somebody else's opinion. So one of the reasons why I think Dr. Fauci is listening to me is the only person other than that paper that I think was using SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2, and I was using SARS-CoV-1 before I found that paper, or probably about the same time, because it seemed to me if we have SARS-CoV-2, then the first one must be SARS-CoV-1. And so it was during that conversation with Senator Dr. Rand Paul that Fauci actually used the first time I'd ever heard him use SARS-CoV-1. And it's after I challenged him several times. So, you know, recognizing that Kerry Mullis was the last person to take on Fauci and he's dead, I was not unaware of the potential risk that poses, but you know, somebody has to do this and I don't really have an option.
I mean, the other option is to do nothing. And I don't, people like us, I don't think have that in their blood. Right. I mean, it's got to do something.
Yeah. You know, at some point in time you have to decide what, you have to make these ethical and moral decisions and then you have to decide this is it. And then you don't look back and you continue forward. I mean, it's a very ugly story of what's happened. You know, and it gives me no pleasure as a research scientist to dig into and see this type of thing happening and these manipulations. I mean, I will tell you that there's a paper that I don't yet have in the book because I decided to keep it out. It's going to be very useful in court where, but I can tell you about it, where Barrick and Daszak found open reading frame 10 in another coronavirus. And open reading frame 10, when you insert it into a coronavirus, impairs the human immune system and interferes with the production of interferon.
Interesting.
Is the message kind of getting similar enough?
Right.
And Barrick didn't begin with SARS-CoV-2. He wandered into SARS-CoV-2. His interest was transmissible gastroenteritis virus, and that was his area that he was originally working in. And if you know how research goes, you know, nothing happens in a straight line, but to the person doing the research, it makes perfect sense. You're following the data as it gets there. And there was a point in time that TGF resulted in him getting to SARS, to coronaviruses. And you know, which, as he's admitted multiple times, is a very easy virus to manipulate, and it is. And as he's admitted several times, it's very easy to keep your signature fingerprint off the virus by just not including it. You know, if you don't say this is from my lab, well, then there's no data, right? Except the problem is you shouldn't say that type of thing and then do that type of research. Right. Because, again, you know, I'm just going to dig it up and get it out there. So, you know, for all the people that are watching this, particularly on social media, and go, Fleming, you're just wasting people's time. The ICC, the International Criminal Court, can't do a thing to the United States because we signed, but we didn't ratify the ICC. Mm-hmm. News bulletin. The Nazis thought the same thing. Okay. The Nazis thought they could not be brought to international court. News bulletin, you can be brought to international court.
Yep.
Okay. And so just because it didn't get ratified doesn't give people in the U.S. free pass. What it just did is it made the boundary of the United States a prison, number one, for these people at best. Because just because you're in that prison doesn't mean you might not leave that prison somehow by someone. So the International Criminal Court, I have the great pleasure of, I'm just going to open this up because I want to use the names of the people and the cases at this mm-hmm. point in time. So I have a presentation that I'm doing on Saturday that I want people to kind of sign off on this. But I want to point out that nobody does this by themselves. There are a number of attorneys that were brave enough to file with the International Criminal Court specific cases. So I want to recognize Kyra S. McCallum and Melinda Main, who both presented case 143/21 for the United Kingdom. For Slovakia, Peter Weiss, Marika Pirozikova, and Eric Schmidt, who presented for Slovakia case 133/21. For France, Patrice Lepillier and Raphael Cohen, who presented case 271/21. And to the Czech Republic, Thomas Nissen, who presented case 326/21. For these cases to be filed jointly with the International Criminal Court. And then I'd like to thank Professor Dr. Kevin McCarron and Professor Luc Montagnier for their providing affidavits along with mine for this case. And then I would like to thank also Moshe Brown, Halil Handler, and Vera Sharav, who are Nazi concentration camp prisoner survivors who have submitted a letter of support for this joint case to the ICC. And currently I have on the website, you can find, if you just go to FlemingMethod.com, the connection for people around the world to file a letter of support to sign a petition for the ICC to encourage the ICC to do what's right and to take this joint case to hold these people accountable. Everybody's signature is critical because the more signatures we get on this, the more the ICC will see the people of the world are calling us to accountability. And we're letting these judges know that independent upon what anybody thinks, everybody right now, you, me, everybody is being judged. History is judging us, and if nobody other than our friends, our children, and our grandchildren, we will be judged for the type of world we leave them.
Exactly.
These judges also will be judged by their children and their grandchildren and the world in general for what they do, just as the Nuremberg judges will be held accountable. So whatever they do with this, history is being written. This is not the last straw. There is also a call for an international court should the ICC not step up. But I'm very serious about this. I've put my neck on the line. Montagnier, McCarron, these three survivors, all of these attorneys. It's very clear we've put ourselves out there, and not for us. Mm-hmm. I get nothing out of this except the satisfaction of protecting the world that I hand to my children and my grandchildren, and knowing that I did the right thing. I mean, you know.
In fact, there's lots of consequences for doing something like this today. So that makes that there's not no benefit, but people will attack you for clearly doing so, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, but the reality is, otherwise, we have given Goering and everybody else of Nazi Germany the opportunity to see that everything that they tried to do has now been done on a mass worldwide scale. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, I show in slides this poster that says, if you want to know what you would have done in the 1930s in Nazi Germany, now you know.
Exactly. This is what's important for people to understand is this is a really important move. In my opinion, this is exactly where the direction that needs to be, the act that needs to be taken. But for people that are rightly concerned about where a lot of this seems to be going in a world sense, in a, you know, World Economic Forum, UN kind of sense, that this kind of thing, the International Criminal Court is about holding these individuals responsible, not necessarily doing anything in regard to changing our government or influencing our policy.
Absolutely.
Right? That's really important. Because a lot of people are concerned about that, and rightly so.
Yeah, it's to hold these people criminally accountable. Criminally. I point out, many people think that the Nuremberg trials was a trial. It was a dozen trials. And they started with the head hotshots who ran the government, the people that were in charge. So the people in this case that are responsible for this virus and for the promotion of these drug vaccines and the interference with doctors treating patients, these are the people that will be at the top. But there were also the doctors' trials, the jurist trials, and then very specific ones for people who had done very specific crimes. So the doctors that did harm to people were held accountable. The judges and the attorneys who changed the laws of Nazi Germany so it could be gotten around were held accountable. This isn't about changing anybody's country or making a one world order. This is about holding the bad people accountable and everybody making sure it happens. Absolutely. This is what we agreed we would never do it again. We all fought to get rid of Nazi Germany, and now we're going to allow the Fourth Reich, which isn't even a country. It's a group of people that have interacted together, and it's not a nation. It's a group of nations. It's a group of people that work together because nobody held them accountable.
Right.
And you know, to some extent, we're all responsible for allowing them to feel like they got that far. And if we continue to allow them to feel that way, we have nobody to blame but ourselves. And our children and our grandchildren will hold us accountable because they will be able to somehow go back in history and look to see what it was like before this type of society existed. And this is what you left us? I remember my parents and my grandparents' concern was to leave for their children and grandchildren a better world,
right?
Not a worse world, a right. Better world.
Yeah, and I think that the engineered apathy in our society is a large part of this. It's been going on for a long time using social media and plenty of others, but things like this happening from a lot of different angles are a positive, and we need to realize that we're not alone. Right, there's a lot of other people out there. As maybe the number has changed since last time I checked, but it's like last on your site or your account, they're currently at over 33,000, almost 34,000 signatures. So I ask everyone out there to sign this, to share it, make sure we're taking the right kind of action, holding people accountable. So just, I really appreciate you being here today, Dr. Fleming, and taking the time to talk about all this, because this is really important work. So is anything else you want to leave us with today, more on the petition, anything else you're researching?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that we're researching, a lot of work for dealing with people who've been vaccinated. There are treatments that look promising, but as I said before, we haven't measured. We're clinically observing. So, you know, I know there's promise in those types of things. So that's not lost. This is not a matter of looking at people who got vaccinated and saying good versus bad. People got vaccinated because they were concerned about the story they were given, which is you'll hurt somebody else that you love. Vaccines don't prevent you from getting infected or transmitting it, but after more than a year of coercion and manipulation and isolating people, it's not surprising that people did that. And for everybody who did that for those reasons, we're with you. You know, now is a time to actually, you know, work together to make the world better for people who have problems down the line to be treated, to allow doctors to treat. But, you know, just like the overuse of antibiotics, when the drug vaccines are driving the variants, and you stop doing what you're doing that is wrong. That's one of the principal things of science or medicine. If what you're doing is causing the problem, you stop doing it. You know, if getting drunk and getting in your car and driving down the interstate at 80 miles per hour gets you in an accident, you don't do that again. Mm-hmm. I've never met anybody who did that a second time. I've met lots of people who've done it the first time. I've never met anybody, not to say it can't happen, who's done it a second time, because you learn from your mistakes. We've had 22 months of learning from our mistakes, being manipulated, being coerced. But, you know, somebody the other day gave me the cute joke, you know, the difference between a conspiracy and fact, 6 months.
That's perfect. That sums up my entire situation from the beginning of this to now. That's exactly the joke right there. 10 times over, we've seen that. Well, I really appreciate you walking us through a lot of this information, because there's a lot of new things that we talked about today and a lot of confirmation that we have about things we've already discussed. So I appreciate your expertise today. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure to be here, Ryan. Thank you.
And to leave everybody off today, I think it's important that something he touched on there at the end, you know, this is not about vaxxed versus unvaxxed. Right. They're trying right now to make this about vax versus unvax. But at the end of the day, a lot of the people in that vaxxed category, as Dr. Fleming just made clear, were pressured into it and are now regretting that choice in a lot of ways. So make sure you do not let this turn you against your neighbor, against your community, because that's exactly what they want. So thank you all for being here. As always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.